This series of Let's Make It Rain is sponsored by PensionBee, a leading online pension provider. They're on a mission to make pensions simple so that customers all over the UK can become pension confident and save for a happy retirement. PensionBee's website and app make it simple for customers to combine their old pension pots, contribute flexibly, and withdraw their pension money all in one place. PensionBee offers a range of pension plans for different savings needs, from a flexible self-employed plan to socially responsible plans like their Impact Plan or Sharia Compliant Plan. Head to pensionbee.com or download the app to get started and become pension confident. Remember, when investing, your capital is at risk. And speaking of investing, you've probably heard me say before that we are our own biggest asset by far, and that includes investing in the next generation. I wrote Cash is Queen exclusively for preteen and teenage girls to equip them with everything they need to take control of their financial futures early. It's been translated into 5 languages and is available worldwide. So grab a copy for you and a friend today. Hi, and welcome to the Let's Make It Rain podcast. I'm your host, Davinia Tomlinson. This podcast is for the rainmakers. Those women who are breaking down walls, building their own empires, defying convention and rejecting stereotypes. Women who are unafraid to have open, honest conversations about money among friends and to share the truths we've been told to keep secret. Don't forget to subscribe, share and download wherever you usually get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, then please leave us a 5-star review. Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Let's Make It Rain podcast. Today, I'm brimming with excitement to be joined by our favourite, my favourite, Instagram auntie, Karen Arthur. Karen is a founder, artist, teacher, dancer, model, podcaster, and now author, like the original multi-hyphenate. Before I hit record, Karen and I were just saying, or Karen was saying, I was thinking about my bio, like multi-hyphenate, I think captures it very well. And I would say that is very accurate. Karen, thank you so, so much for being here today. I know that you are super busy, and even more so now, following the announcement of the forthcoming publication of your brand new book, Grandma's Locks. Yeah. Huge congratulations on that. Can we start by talking about Grandma's Locks, where the inspiration for that came from and who you are grandmother to?
Oh my goodness me. First of all, well, thanks. Thanks for having me. I almost said welcome. It's not me answering the questions.
You're so used to asking the questions.
Yeah. I'm so used to asking the questions because I have my podcast, as you mentioned, Menopause Waspler, and I also have a bi-weekly radio show called Can We Talk? So I'm quite used to me being the person asking the questions. But anyway, not welcome. Thank you is what I wanted to say. Yeah, Grandma's Locks. So my grandson is called Kiko and he's 4. And he is mixed race. His father is white and his mother is of Bajan and Sierra Leone heritage. I am of Bajan heritage. My parents are from Barbados. And I wrote the poem when he was about 4 months old. It was lockdown. It was March 2020. He was born in October 2019, so it's kind of a lockdown baby. And I was so full of love for this blinking child. No one warned you. You may not have many grandmas listening or grandparents listening, but no one warned you about how all-encompassing the love for a grandchild is and how different it is for your love for your children. It's like this secret club. Honestly. Anyway, so I wrote this poem and it's about his hair. It's about his hair and it's about my hair. So my hair journey, my hair wouldn't grow. I have 4C hair. I never really understood it. I had all sorts of different, I relaxed it. I jerry curled it. I had extensions in it, you know, as I was growing up. And when I was pregnant with my second child in hospital, I decided I'm going to lock it up. That'll be easy, I thought. Dear reader, loxing has been the hardest and most fulfilling journey I've ever had with my hair. Let me tell you, my hair grew. It grew down my back. I had to start cutting it. I felt like it was just incredible. And so my lox journey, in a sense, informed me and how I became and who I was growing into. Then my grandson's born And he's got very different hair. His hair is springy and loose and beautiful curls. And I was aware that he might be exoticized. I've had to tell people not to touch his hair. His mother has had to advocate for his hair care. It's been a lot. And I wanted him to celebrate his hair. He's about to go to primary school in September, which is also the same week the book comes out, the 5th of September. I want him to be proud. I want him to be able to say, this is me, this is who I am. And so the book, basically, one thing led to another and Tate Publishing picked it up. This is the news. And so it has been turned into a beautiful hardback book. The illustrations, the artwork is by a wonderful woman based in Manchester called Camilla Rue. She's the Camru on Instagram. And she has really captured the joy of our relationship. So it's about my heritage. It's about my ancestors. It's an homage to my mother. It's an homage to tiny Karen, who didn't know what was going on with my hair or who I was as a young black girl brought up in the middle of Oxfordshire with only one other person of colour at my school until my brother came up, you know?
Wow.
So it's a lot. And it's honestly, it's beautiful. I'm so proud of it. Yeah, I have lots of ideas as to how to celebrate that. The next thing is, I think I want to turn some of the pages into fabric and make something out of it.
Oh, wow. And I see a cartoon as well on CDs in my mind. Yeah, I see a cartoon. And, you know, I suppose just to stick a pin in that for a second, for anybody that isn't a black woman listening that is like, what the hell is 4C? I would encourage you to look that up because it is too much for us to explain in a 1 hour long podcast. Yeah. But know that our relationship with our hair as black women, if you have black friends, you will know our relationship with our hair is a very sacred one.
100%.
And there are many twists and turns. If you are a Timothée girl and grew up, or a herbal essences girl and grew up able to just go into the supermarket or the chemist
and, swish,
and just buy your shampoo and conditioner, then you will be unfamiliar with the struggles of being a black woman growing up in the UK. And I remember, you know, now when there's this proliferation of black hair care brands and you can get some of them, not all, but some of them in Boots. So Boots, for those people listening outside of the UK, is a big pharmacy chain, if you like, or retailer. But before that, we really couldn't get anything for our hair easily. And if we did, we had to pay through the nose for it. And we were very much othered. And so that basically kind of set the foundation for what our relationship with our hair might feel like in the UK, at least. So as I say, the Timothée girls, we used to watch those adverts and, you know, and think, oh gosh, look at them swishing, you know, and it was very evocative, the idea of all of the coconuts and the, you know, these beautiful blossoms that were in their shampoos. Ours did not garner the same kinds of amazing ad campaigns or anything. So what Karen is sharing about the struggles and having to make peace with our own hair and find our own niche in terms of what worked for us is something that is very precious. It may sound quite trivial, but it is not at all. The magnitude of it for us and the impact on our lives and our self-esteem is quite immense. So I would encourage you to start by looking up the numbering systems. When Karen says that she has 4C hair, I have 4C hair too, then you will understand more about what that means. So
I mean,
Karen,
4C hair is great for locks.
Yes, it is. I have locks too.
Yeah, yeah.
So Karen, thank you so much for sharing about Grandma's locks and giving us that sneak preview. I'm really excited about that and particularly the illustrations and to see how that joy that you convey in your everyday existence just leaps off the page through the illustrations. So I can't wait to see those.
Thank you.
So let's talk about your joy.
Let's.
And in particular, how you show up almost as an ambassador. And I don't necessarily know that this is something that you set out to do, but your feed, and as I say, you're my favorite and probably everyone's favorite Instagram auntie. It's such a joy. And you are very open about being a woman in your 60s. I know it's wild. Like if you follow Karen, you'll be like 60s. But anyway, we haven't got time to get into that. Karen is a woman in her 60s, but you are very good at reminding other women to take up space, irrespective of age.
Yeah.
Is that something that you do consciously to empower and inspire others, or has that evolved over time?
Both. I am very conscious shower-upper. I am conscious about what I wear. I'm conscious about what I say, and it doesn't mean that I overthink things. I am honest to a fault, but no, I have not always been this way, far from it. And in fact, I would say this voice, menopause, anxiety and depression, gave me this voice. I'm now 62. I was a teacher for 28 years. I started as a dance teacher. I did a performing arts degree in Leicester. Then I moved to London and I was teaching dance full time in secondary school, in a mixed school, then a girls' school. Then I moved across to be a pastoral leader. So I was head of year, head of house. And I ended up as a head of house in a boys' school. And I loved that job until that job didn't love me. Anybody who's a teacher who is listening will understand what I'm talking about. Teaching has changed. The teaching profession is being eroded almost in the same way as the NHS. Certainly in the UK, teachers are not valued anywhere near enough, considering the responsibility we have. And shout out and props to all teachers out there who are just trying to live and to impart their knowledge. So it was hard work. And all of my knowledge of my menopause in particular, and perimenopause stage, which wasn't a phrase when I was going through it. I didn't know what that was. It's all in retrospect. So I started to get brain fog. I started to forget to go to meetings. I started to become very anxious. I would have panic attacks. And I didn't want to tell anybody, one, because I didn't know what I was going through. And two, there was a lot of shame I felt around thinking I was going mad. And I thought that if I told people at work that I couldn't do my job, then I would get the sack. And then how would I pay my mortgage? How would I look after my two daughters who were just going to university? I was a single mother. I had left an abusive relationship a few years before. And so I was focusing on being the best that I could be for my kids so I could not only survive, but thrive. But I realized now I was just barely surviving. And I ended up one night crying over my laptop, having spent 2 hours working, slaving over it and Googling the symptoms for depression and realizing that I was ticking all the boxes and thinking, perhaps I need to get some help here. So I remember scrolling down my contacts and my phone and bypassing every single one of my family because I didn't want to worry them. And also they weren't near. So there wasn't much they could do. I felt like I needed an intervention. And I called my good friend, Carolyn, who is normally never picks up the phone. She's the last person to pick up the phone. It was a landline. Her husband was out. Her kids were at gymnastics. And she said, wait for my husband to get back. I'll be there when I've got the car. And she was over in 20 minutes, 30 minutes. And we just sat and chatted. And that started a longer journey towards getting better. But still, I ignored what she said. She told me that I needed some time off. I told her I'm fine. I just need a day off. She urged me to go to the doctors the next day. I did in the end, but only because I was worried of letting her down. The doctor gave me a week off, which went to 2, which went to 3, which went to 6. And then I went back to work in January. And within 3 weeks, I was off again. And I tell you what, I was trying to get better to go back to work. And that was my mistake. Because I needed to get better, full stop. I needed to not focus on the productivity bit. I needed to focus on me. And when I had this epiphany in March, which was, I'm not going back to that job, that's when I could truly start to get better. But it doesn't happen overnight. Mental well-being is a very complicated thing. And whilst I knew that I was menopausal in the sense that I was having hot flushes, no one, including my doctor, was making the connection between poor mental well-being and the onset of menopause. And I'm not saying that menopause causes poor mental well-being. I'm saying that if you feel out of sorts, things aren't quite right, it's not just a physical thing, it's a mental thing, then it may be the onset of perimenopause and it is worth speaking to your doctor about it. But I didn't know any of that stuff. I just knew I couldn't do my job. So I left and I thought, oh, I'll get better now. And the void, the gap that my teaching career left just gave me space to move deeper into poor mental well-being. I was going to say get worse, but I really don't see it that way because although from a productivity viewpoint, it was worse because literally I didn't do anything. I meditated. I learned to mindfully meditate. I deepened my yoga and stretch practice. Never left my house. And if I left my house, my hair was down, my hood was up, I was wearing baggy clothes, I was wearing black.
I can't actually imagine you in black.
Yeah, right? Right? I didn't care about washing. All I cared was that if someone saw me, how I would explain. So I spent a lot of time hiding. You know, if you go to Sainsbury's, hiding at one end of an aisle until a parent that I knew went past. So I wouldn't have to explain why I wasn't teaching anymore, or I didn't want to see anybody I knew. Completely opposite to the person I am now. Okay. And two things I did. I started mindful meditation. I got silent. I turned the gaze on myself. And the other thing I did is I decided that I was worthy of therapy, because before, when I split from my partner, I did everything but therapy. I put my kids in therapy, but I just thought I'll keep my head down and work really, really, really hard and be the best that I can be, which is common. And I thought, I can't afford therapy. Therapy is too expensive. It is expensive, but it's worth every penny. And I recognize that that's a privilege. And I thought I'd go for 6 weeks and be better, be fixed. And 3 years later... Best gift I ever gave myself. And I haven't ruled out going back. This was 10 years ago. 10 years ago this year. Yeah, because I'm 62 now. Yeah. Incredible. Incredible.
It is incredible. And you know what's particularly, I mean, there is so much in what you just said. I want to kind of almost unpack each layer because I suppose taking each theme in reverse, isn't it incredible how we deny ourselves the support and the help that we so desperately need? But if our children might need that same help, oh my gosh, like it's just no question at all. We're going to find the money. Moms, perhaps dads as well, we are going to find the money. So when you felt that, you know, after your marital breakdown, you know, my children probably could do with some support, you are going to do what you've got to do to make sure that they get the support that they need.
Yeah,
and I think as women,
fix everybody but yourself.
Always.
Because we are not socialized to believe as women.
Not at all.
And as Black women in particular, that we are worthy.
We are dedicated to a life of servitude.
There you go.
And, you know, and then we realize, gosh, it serves everyone except me. And then you almost feel guilty for having that thought. So you suppress it until eventually you can't suppress it anymore. And it's like, you know, cork popping out of a bottle of champagne and it's just overflowing, but with far less effervescence, I guess. So there's that. But you also talked about the idea that feeling worried about the perception that others might have, because as much as menopause isn't necessarily, or certainly in the past, and you were definitely one of the people that's bringing it much more into the public domain and making sure that we can normalize conversations around it. But I think in the past, people just associated menopause with it's a hot flush, and on sitcoms and things on TV, that's what you'd see, or you'd hear them say, she's going through the change. I remember distinctly, you know, those sitcoms in the 80s would say, oh, she's going through the change. And there'd be some kind of giggle about these women that were going through the change or sticking their heads in the freezer. And I'd be like, oh, that's funny. That woman's hot and she's put her head in the freezer. So you would just associate menopause with that. But now we've got so much more awareness. And even I mean, as somebody that, you know, my next milestone will be menopause. I could be in perimenopause now. Actually, I have no idea. For a woman in her 40s, I don't have the level of knowledge and awareness. And I know it's incumbent upon me to go and seek that out. But we just had very little knowledge. And when we would seek out that kind of help from the healthcare profession, we'd have varying degrees of success, let's say.
There are layers to that.
Yeah.
There are layers to
that.
Can
we talk about that?
Yeah. When are women encouraged? When have women in the past been encouraged to talk about what's happening with our bodies, with our hormones? We're not encouraged. When are we encouraged to put ourselves first? I mean, the other layers are around patriarchy. Well, it's patriarchy, that's it. White supremacy and patriarchy. So basically, you know, we've got this system we chose. Well, I didn't choose it, but they chose a system that says that the youth will be revered and getting older as a woman will be a problem. So the minute we lose our usefulness, we don't look particularly what is considered to be sexy, our bits aren't put anymore, we can't have babies. So what's the point of us? So we're encouraged to become invisible. We're encouraged to be quiet. We're encouraged to sit in the corner and wait for our grandkids. Or we are ridiculed and laughed at and called names and vilified. The world does not like strong women. They definitely do not like, despite the phrase, which serves us no purpose at all, strong black woman, they don't like us to bite back. They don't like us to speak back. I am determined. You talked about me showing up. Is it deliberate? 100% it's deliberate, because I have no intention of becoming quiet unless I want to. You know, I feel like as women, when we get older, we have more knowledge. We have more experience. Why would I be quiet? That makes no sense to me. And I will also add, as a mother, certainly one of the gifts I've given to my children is showing up as myself, because my children, their role model is someone who just gets up and gets on with it. So how can they fail? I mean, I feel scared a lot of the time, but that, apparently that's a good thing. My youngest daughter says, you know, feel the fear and do it anyway. If you have a little bit of something in the pit of your stomach, I know fear is supposed to protect us, but our bodies don't know the difference between fear and excitement. So what if that's excitement? What's the best that could happen? The other thing is around being ignored. And, you know, when you go to the doctors and the doctor dismisses you, or they say that, oh, you're too, especially as a black woman, you're too young to be menopausal because you don't look a certain way. Or there's unconscious bias going on. There's medical racism around that. This podcast isn't long enough to go through that. So my thing is, you can't please everybody. So you may as well just please yourself, innit? Especially the menopause thing you said about, it's on you to do your own research and find out. Yeah, you're absolutely right. There is a lot of information out there now, and it can be very confusing. But I would say the biggest thing for me is feeling confident. If you do your research when you go to your doctors, and if the doctor says something that doesn't sit right with you, you know your body. We know ourselves best. And so we need to really learn to listen to, and that's a big bit of a broad phrase, but listen to, as in, I know that if I eat a family bag of crisps at 10 o'clock at night, the next morning, I'm not going to be able to go for a run. I'm going to feel bloated all day. I'm not going to feel great. I know that if I eat too much chocolate, I love chocolate, I have a very sweet tooth, after a week or so, my gums are going to start to play up. We know what works for us and what doesn't work for us. We have, you know, people in our lives who, when we leave them, we feel a bit shit, but we meet them because we feel like we should. There's so much.
There is. I mean, self-advocacy when it comes to our health is a huge area. I mean, it's something that, again, is becoming much more prominent. And I think when I cast my mind back to my own journey, as somebody that, touch wood, has generally always been in relatively good health, but like lots of young women, I remember going on the pill. You know, as soon as I was sexually active, I was on the pill. And it masked polycystic ovaries. So I had PCOS and had no idea that my periods were irregular until I came off the pill and was trying to have my now two precious mini rainmakers and realized, well, what the hell is going on with my periods? Like, why is my cycle 53 days long one month? And why is it 14 days long another month? And whenever I would go to the doctor, like, I mean, the first time I had that 53 day long cycle, I was like, well, I'm definitely pregnant. I must've spent £100 on pregnancy.
Wait, that's 2 months. Lord have mercy.
I'm like, I'm definitely pregnant, because what? Yeah. All of the pregnancy tests came back negative. And I'm like, well, something's up. So I went to the doctor and they're like, oh, it's fine. It's just your body adjusting to you having been on the pill for so long. Though. Right. And I was like, okay, well, they must know. And it took me taking up, and again, this is a privilege, my private healthcare through work and going to see a gynecologist who did some tests and said, no, actually, you've got polycystic ovaries. This is going to be your treatment plan. This is what we're going to need to do. So getting that diagnosis that I had polycystic ovaries, I was like, what on earth? And of course, you go immediately to Google and I'm like, oh my God, so like I'm trying to have a child, can't have a child. What is it telling me? All of these sorts of things. And the very clinical manner in which that information was delivered, you know, it was very much, this is what's going to happen. If you are going to have treatment on the NHS, then they will give you treatment. Basically, they'll monitor you for 2 years before they will offer you IVF, but you might struggle to have a baby. Bye now, go back to work. And I'm literally in bits, like, what on earth? What do you mean? 2 years? No way. And that, I think, was the first point at which I realized, first of all, if you didn't speak up in the first place, you wouldn't have been referred to go and see a specialist who could help you. The manner of the specialist wasn't great, but at least I've got a diagnosis now. But then I had to go and see a different specialist. I was like, I don't want to see you anymore. I need to see a woman. I want to see a woman. Doesn't necessarily mean all women are great, but the gynecologist that I'd seen was a man. I found his manner very flippant and dismissive. When I went to see go and see a woman, and again, had similar sets of tests, and she was much more empathetic. She was much warmer. Again, that doesn't necessarily mean that she was warmer because she was a woman, but at least she was able to say, I can empathize with what you might be thinking and feeling, but actually this is what the workaround might be for you and it will be fine. Within 6 months of me seeing her, I was pregnant with baby number one. The point is, if you don't self-advocate when it comes to your healthcare, and because we've been trained and conditioned as women or as people in general to just, obviously we revere the healthcare system, but sometimes it works against us because we just accept what we're being told, even if our bodies are telling us the complete opposite. And so when it comes to women's health and our menopause and anything that's centered specifically around women's health, what approach would you advise us to take if we feel that we're hitting a brick wall? For anyone listening that's like, oh my God, Dav, that's me, or I'm really struggling, or I've got this concern, what would you encourage them to do?
Man, first of all, we have to get rid of that white coat syndrome thing in our head that we're brought up to believe that because it's a doctor.
Yes, they know best.
Most of us have sat in an appointment and spoken about our symptoms of something and a doctor has Googled in front of us. I could have done that at home, babe. Do you know what I mean? Yes, they have an education. Yes, they have a certain knowledge, but it's guesswork. We are experiments a lot of the time, especially when you turn up with something that they're not sure about. And if you're turning up and the doctor already has an unconscious bias around you wasting their time or whatever, then that's not going to help. So my advice, I have interviewed in season 6 of Menopause Whilst Black, two particular doctors, Dr. Itunu Johnson and Dr. Jocelyn Tedajo, and both of them are incredibly talking about what to do when you go to a doctor's because they're doctors themselves. And all of them are about, one, doing your own research, and two, advocating for yourself. Personally, I have sat and basically said, I'm not leaving until I'm referred. A bit bullshy, I know. Or my favourite thing is, I realise that this may not be your expertise. Can you find me someone who knows? You know, I'm basically saying, I need to speak to someone who knows what they're talking about. Now, I am never bullshy. I never have to. Maybe I come across as, maybe that's older privilege. Maybe that's people assuming that I know shit that I don't. That's fine. I'll take that. But also, it may also be that I'm confident. I'm confident about my body. I know what doesn't feel right, et cetera, et cetera. And the other thing is that we're talking about this as if it's easy to get a doctor's appointment in the first place. It's not. People of colour are under... don't get me started, you know. People of colour are underserved by the medical profession. You talked about being able to go private, and you know that's a privilege. How many people can do that? How many people can say, actually, that's not working for me, let me go this way? So I would say, if you can, have a look at the clauses in your work contract. If you're working, then do that. But some of us have got to get time off. Some of us have got to, may have had a terrible time with the last doctor and not want to go back. Maybe we are going to see, when we say, to the receptionist, can we see a female doctor? They roll their eyes or they say, oh, we haven't got anybody available. This is why it's so important to stand your ground. You have a right to be given exact same amount of care as everybody else. And so stand your ground. You're not making yourself a nuisance. You are absolutely worthy. And so my advice is just to go for it. But I would say, and I will say this, go to Menopause Whilst Black season 6 and listen to those episodes, because one of the doctors, I wish I could remember her name, she uses the phrase culturally competent care. This is about doctors being trained to understand the nuances around our care when it comes to speaking to people across different cultures. And I think that's a wonderful phrase that we need to go in knowing that that training is coming.
Yes,
but, you know, brilliant. It's slow.
It is slow.
It takes time.
And it's not unique to us either. You know, culturally competent care means having a sensitivity to a vast array of different cultures and the intricacies of different cultures and being exactly teachable as well. Yeah. You know, exactly as you describe, it's not saying that, you know, yes, we respect your training and we're here for your expertise, but it doesn't mean that you are on a throne presiding over your loyal subjects and that we must not challenge and we must not answer back. And I think, you know, that, you know, will take some unlearning, if you like. The generation that's coming up after us are much more willing to challenge because they just view it as their birthright. They're not just taking it, are they? I love that for them. So Karen, just for anybody listening then, because I think, and you know, myself and lots of my peers, so women in their late 30s, women in their 40s, and even younger actually, I think there are so many misconceptions about what menopause is. We've touched on one or two of them, some of the big stereotypes. As I say, you know, it was previously, we wouldn't even use the word menopause, you know, in not in media, it was referred to as the change, which is, it's wild. I did a podcast with someone who said, I think she might have said in Japanese culture, she certainly alluded to some Japanese themes, but the idea of the second spring, which I thought was beautiful. So she talked about that. I will link to that episode along with your episode 6 in the show notes. But I think the idea that we all had of menopause in the past was of somebody that was elderly or approaching being elderly, confined to their homes, having hot flushes all the time, and then sticking their head in the freezer. I mean, I remember even in the Cosby Show, Claire, who we all adored, she was doing that. She was, you know, beautiful Claire with the perfectly coiffed hair and the perfect makeup and the beautiful clothes. She was sticking her head in the fridge. And the idea that was projected was that menopausal women will be volatile, they will be emotional. And no one's suggesting that those things might not be true. That might be part of the mix. But that was all we were viewed as. It was such a reductive depiction of women going through menopause. So let's just dispel some of those myths. What are the clues that you would want women to look out for? And it doesn't have to be exhaustive. And I know, as you say, you are not a doctor, but just based on your experiences and what you've heard from the many women that you will have spoken to, what kinds of things would you want us to be aware of that might warrant further investigation?
I think the first thing is to be aware that you may feel slightly out of sorts. Some people call it an existential crisis. I now realise fully that my perimenopause was signified by me feeling, well, is this it then? Is this my life? People often talk about the physical symptoms. And whilst I understand that, you should be thinking about physical symptoms. And they might be anything from hot flushes to tinnitus to vaginal atrophy, which is dry vagina, which is basically makes for very painful sex, or itchy vulva. It might be feeling like there are insects crawling under your skin. Your skin changes, your periods change. A lot of my guests on my, that's one, brain fog, forgetting words. A lot of my guests talk about their periods being the first thing that went a bit doolally. So from someone who had, for example, regular as clockwork periods, they then started to become, you know, a longer cycle or a shorter cycle, or that they became heavier, you know, that kind of thing. So we tend to take notice of physical changes before we take notice of what's going on in our mind, because we tend to suppress the stuff that's in our mind because we feel there's nothing we can do about it. But if you feel something's not quite right in both senses, it is still worth going to the doctors, because as I said, you know yourself, and doctors should be able to go on to tell you whether you're perimenopausal, which is when you're, you know, estrogen, your eggs start to become less and estrogen starts to fluctuate and gradually starts to leave your body, preparing you for menopause, which is when you've had 12 consecutive months of no periods at all. So there are people who say, oh, well, I haven't had a period for 5 months, I must be menopausal. Listen, that thing can come back with a vengeance. And then you have to start the clock again. It's literally like starting the stopwatch again. So menopause is one day. It's the day after you've had 12 months without a period. And then after that, you're postmenopausal. So there's so many different changes. You might find that your hair starts thinning. I certainly my locks started to thin on top. I had very long locks, and my research was to pile it up loosely on my head. So I started to use head wraps more because it wasn't as heavy. If you have straighter hair, then the common wisdom is not to pull it back so much and not to put so much product on it and not to blow dry it so much, that kind of thing. As I say, it can be very confusing. I'm going to say, don't be scared. I think people are scared of menopause. And I think sometimes it's because there are so many symptoms. When you listen to that, it can become scary. But once you get a handle on your menopause care, and that's not just things like, let's say, hormone replacement therapy, which a minority of people take, particularly in the UK. But because they are also the people who were amplified in the media, you could be forgiven for thinking that everybody's taking HRT.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's interesting for you to say that it's a minority. Wow.
It's the minority. It's that my last, I mean, it might be growing, but certainly the last account was something like 15% of people, because not everybody can take hormone therapy, medically hormone therapy, but of the people who could, it was 15%. And of that, half of them were Black women. You have to remember that there will be people who don't even know they're menopausal, who are pushing through, yes, so to speak, which we, yes, don't need to do.
I think my mom and my grandmother's generations,
oh my goodness,
definitely.
Absolutely.
I don't even think I would have known when, yeah, they were going through menopause. I have to say, I do remember, yeah, seeing my mom visibly, spontaneously breaking out into a sweat. But she definitely didn't have a conversation with my sister and I. And I also think because I have a history of fibroids in my family and a history of, and you know, now me with PCOS, I think certainly for the women in my family, my mom and my grandmother and perhaps my great-grandmother, but would have had hysterectomies quite early. And again, when I look back and think about their healthcare and whether that was actually the right option for them, I remember there was a woman on my course at university. She was a mature student, but you know, I'm thinking mature student. We were 18. She was probably 25. That seemed like a big age gap at the time. But by the time we graduated, and when she was 30, she'd had fibroids. And I distinctly remember going to visit her after graduation. She couldn't come to our ceremony. And they'd given her a hysterectomy. And I just think now, casting my mind back, you know, 20 years, thinking, was that actually the right solution for her? Or was it just the simplest for the NHS to just say, and I'm not at all suggesting that they were like, well, you know, they're Black women, they've got fibroids, just give them a hysterectomy. Give them a hysterectomy because then we don't have to deal with the problem again. And I'm like, maybe for my mom and my gran, I mean, they were both in their mid-40s, but I'm like, but that's not far off the age I am now. I can't imagine you giving me a hysterectomy and plunging me into instant menopause. Like, what on earth? And for a woman of 30, were there alternatives that were not considered? So again, it's back to the self-advocacy piece.
We have to look at our diet. We have, yeah, to look at our stress. Stress is a huge factor in how you experience menopause. And stress is not just work stress. It will be about your relationships with your family, with your extended family, with your friends. We get to an age where we continue to do things that no longer serve us because we don't see an alternative. We have to consider ourselves worthy. We have to say, we have to remove ourselves from situations that don't fill us. This is a big thing for me, is around setting boundaries. I just want to recommend some books about periods. One is about the pill. It's by Kate Muir, and it's called Everything You Wanted to Know About the Pill and Were Afraid to Ask. And that's just come out. Book about periods, and someone I interviewed for, it was episode 7 of season 6, Lanice Brothers wrote a book, You Can Have a Better Period. And she is an absolute go-to around hormones and around periods and around how you manage your stress, how you look at your diet, you know, that kind of thing. But also ensuring that you're doing some kind of exercise. Walking is the most common one, but weight training is, and by weight, I mean resistant training, sorry. When I say weights, people get, oh my God, I'm going to be picking up big dumbbells. No, not unless you want to. Resistance training, running. I got into running when I think about it in the last 10 years, you know. And I only started running because I was bored of walking. I thought, let me see if I can do this. And here we are. Dance, yoga, gardening, move your body, stretching your body. As we get older, our body becomes less and less able to do the things that we took for granted when we were 20 and 30. And if we stop moving it, if we don't, you know, constantly stretch it and take advantage of the fact that it can move, then at some point you will drop something on the floor and you won't be able to pick it up. Or you'll go to pick it up and you'll crick your back. I also want to add here that menopause is not a one-size-fits-all. Everybody experiences menopause very differently. And some people, 20% of people, will not experience hot flushes, but they might get night sweats. Some people don't get vaginal atrophy. Other people will. So whilst it's important to talk with people and get over the embarrassment or the taboo, let's just talk about menopause, because the more we talk about it, the more people will feel that they're not alone. And I just want to add one more thing, because I need to say, as a Black woman, any Black women listening to us, Black women are likely to start our menopause 8.5 months and up to 2 years earlier than our white counterparts. So pay attention earlier. And what's fun, and we're often going to experience menopause for longer, symptoms such as hot flushes, the physical symptoms. So just be aware of what is happening and don't feel that this strong Black woman, I must suffer through, I must soldier on because my grandparents did and my parents did before me. None of that, babe. None of that. Do what works for you. I take HRT. Let's just put that out there. If you want to take HRT, do it. It's down to you what you decide to do, because only you know what is best for your body. And with a little trial and error and a little patience, you will get it right. So you can then start to move into your 60s and your 70s, God willing, universe willing, and absolutely boss it like I intend to do and am.
I love that. And you know, I mean, I'm staggered to hear that statistic about Black women going through menopause sooner than our white friends, our white female friends. That's crazy. Do you know, is there any research as to why?
And for those who like science, that's the Swan Report. You can Google that. If you put Black women in menopause, a whole heap of stuff will come up on Google.
That must explain. Yeah, that must explain, because I'm very interested to understand why.
And we don't know why.
No, it's the same as Black girls going through puberty sooner.
The reason we don't know why is the research isn't there. The research is only just ramping up around menopause anyway. So the nuanced research is, you know, further down the line, but it's coming. The point is, it's happening. Pay attention. You know, and anybody who has ovaries is going to go through menopause at some point in different and varying ways.
Wow. No, my head is spinning, because now I'm thinking to myself, when I finish this episode, I need to do a bit of self-inquiry and go, I mean, Dav, maybe you're experiencing perimenopausal symptoms now and you're just doing the thing that you always do, which is to go, it's fine. Like, I'm definitely that person that just powers through, soldiers on, and treating it as a badge of honor. I'm trying to do that less and less now. And so this is a real kind of moment of truth for me. It's an opportunity for me to put my money where my mouth is and to start to pay attention to myself. But just changing tack slightly, because I want to come back to menopause. But you said something that really resonated about, we need to talk about this. We need to normalize conversations. We need to have more open discourse about the symptoms of menopause. Even the fact that you said, you know, menopause is a single day, and then the day after you're postmenopausal. That's wild, because you're thinking, no, menopause is the whole season. Like, menopause is the whole time while you're having the symptoms and you're waiting for your periods to stop. Again, misconceptions. So the more we talk about it, the more we dispel some of those misconceptions and squash some of those myths that have us in a chokehold, which include everyone's on HRT. That's the only solution. So if you can't take HRT, then you're finished. Just forget it. You've got to do it yourself. It reminds me of the parallels with our money as women. And you talked about, you know, obviously as a multi-hyphenate, and particularly as somebody that's worked in the creative industries, I know that, you know, from lots of my Rainmaker clients, again, gosh, you've got a downpour. Rainmaker in the house, that's why.
We're in the Caribbean, of course you've got a downpour.
But when it comes to our money, and as I was saying, you know, for you as a creative, I imagine, you know, thinking about your income and those different income streams, it makes for a very interesting relationship with money, I would suggest. And so from your perspective, How would you describe your relationship with money, how it's evolved? I know that you've touched on leaving an abusive relationship, an abusive marriage. And, you know, I interviewed the CEO of Surviving Economic Abuse. That's certainly something that's becoming more and more prominent now. We've seen campaigns from HSBC talking about, we can help you if you are struggling or believe you are suffering from economic abuse. So there's so much that goes into it. And again, really important for women to have these conversations with one another. How would you describe your personal relationship with money?
It's really evolved. I've always been a saver. I've always been someone who was meticulous about saving, and I'd be very scrupulous with money. But I was coming from a place of scarcity, even though I was, you know, I was brought up in a working class household. My mother was a single mum. I'm the eldest of four. You know, she worked in a factory. I'm very definitely middle class now, as are my siblings. I watched my mother when my father left. He moved to Canada, to one of the two states that British jurisdiction couldn't reach. And so she only had child support, but she didn't get anything from him. I don't know how she did it, but she did it. So from an early age, as soon as I could get a Saturday job, I got one. There was no way that my mother would be able to afford the things that I wanted. Not that I wanted a lot. It's just nice to have your own money. So from 14, I was working at various Saturday jobs, but my favourite was in Littlewoods. I was folding sweaters all day, but they had me next door to the tannoy. So I had a good voice, I suppose. And so they would get me to do all the announcements, where to go to get 5p off something, or if there was a lost child or that kind of thing. And I was so close to turning on the microphone and singing, I did it my, you know. But I always made my own money. I went to uni in the days when you got a grant. They paid me to go to uni. And let me tell you, I made that pittance of a grant last the entire term, because you got the money every term. I never had another job at uni, which is incredible when I consider what my daughters had to do for where they had to take out loans. My mother said something to me which has stuck, and it was always, if you have a credit card debt and you have savings, then you don't have savings. So I have always paid my credit card debt off. I've never put anything on my credit card unless I knew I could pay it off, or I was happy with swallowing, giving them some extra money, you know, at the end of the month. So I always saved. But my partner would tease me about it. I'd go to the cash point and I'd take out £30, and he'd go and take £100 out. He'd say, oh, is that all you... Because I felt like I don't want to live beyond my means. Don't get me wrong, I like my holidays, I had my car, I like my clothes. But I was very measured about not spending too much. Then when we split up, I had savings. So it meant I could remortgage the house, I could change my will. I made a list of all the things that I didn't need to do anymore. I stopped my gym membership. I used to get my legs waxed every two. I stopped all of that. And then I went through a stage where when the kids were young, we would hemorrhage money during the summer holidays because, you know, hello, especially in London. And so in September.
Yeah, summer holidays are horrific. Yeah. Really tough.
Yeah, every September for years, I'd sit down, look at my finances, get a loan out for something like £2,000 and pay it off in a year. And that would be my buffer. But now I've reached an age where I'm in my 60s. I hit my teacher's pension age. So when I split with my partner, we had a house together. A few things happened. It might be serendipity. It might be the universe. Who knows? So I get to a point where I've got the house, but I'm paying over the odds because I've remortgaged it. I have a good salary, but I'm paying a lot of money for the mortgage. But what I do is I pay over. So instead of paying say it's £1,500, I'm paying £1,600. So I'm gradually chipping away. When I left teaching, I still had 5 years before I could retire. And I called the pension people and they said, oh, you can take early retirement, but we will take a third of your lump sum and a third of your monthly pension. And I was like, no, I'm good. I'm going to wait 5 years. Meanwhile, I've got no income. So I'm taking jobs like alterations. I'd been sewing for years. I'm taking jobs that I don't really want to do, but I'm doing them because I feel I need to have the money. I'm doing supply teaching. I'm absolutely hating it. And one day I sat in bed and I was like, I'm not going to do anything I don't love doing anymore. It was like an epiphany. I'd written it in my journal. No word of a lie. When I decided I wasn't going to do that, I had four different phone calls from supply agencies asking me to go into work at this particular point. And each one I had to say no to. Because this is what happens. When you decide to step into what you really want to do, the universe tests you. How many times have you said, I'm not going to respond to that 11 p.m. hey, how you doing? Text.
Oh, and then, Lordy. We're getting WYD.
And then the next thing you know, he turns up. You know, how many times have you decided not to do something and then something has turned up that if you turn and do that, oh, it'll just make it easier. It won't. So I found that when I chose, this is going to sound really woo-woo, but honestly, I'm a big journaler. I write things down. I write down what I want. I write down what I had for dinner. I write down what the weather's like. I write down everything. And I chose to decide that I was going to only do things that I loved doing. And yes, it was hard. And I would get down, I had some savings and my savings were going down. And then two things happened. One was that my ex tried to sell the flat that we had together. He had been taking all the rent. I had made no income of that. And he tried to sell it. And the estate agent called me and said, your name's on the deeds. Do you mind if he sells the flat? And I was like, he can sell it, but I need some of that. Because basically what was supposed to happen is I was supposed to keep the house. He was supposed to take my name off the mortgage of the flat. And then he would have that property and I would have the one we were living in. Because he didn't do it, years down the line, when he went to sell it, he had to ask my permission. So just as I was getting to my last mortgage payment and I'm looking around thinking, where's that money come from? My man dropped 60 grand into my account because he had had, yes, the tax man took a load, but it meant I had a little bit more money, which meant that whilst I was building my fashion design business and faking it till I made it and not having any clients and making things and putting them on Instagram and doing all the things, whilst I was doing that, I still eat, pay my mortgage, you know, make sure my kids were all right, and so on and so forth. So then we fast forward to now. I sold the house in London. I got to COVID and I was like, if we're going to keep going in and out of global pandemics, I want a view. So I moved to the seaside. I didn't know anybody. I had two acquaintances here. And I thought, yeah, again, this is about doing what I love to do. And because I was able to sell the house, it meant that I had money to buy a flat. My relationship with money is still that I will spend money on experiences. I don't smoke. I'm not a big drinker. I don't buy a lot of clothes. I wear You're Happy. I wear clothes. I rewear clothes. I thrift shop. I wear secondhand clothes. But I like a good holiday. I will go to Barbados where my family lives every year. I've just booked a few weeks in Mauritius. I've never been. I can't wait. You know, I feel that life is far too short not to live it fully. And whilst I am fully aware of that privilege that I have, I worked for that. This money did not land in my lap. My mum had nothing. My father had nothing when they moved to the UK. And when my dad left my mum, she worked hard doing a shitty job, factory job, to make sure that we were okay. And when I said, I want to go off to uni to study dance, she was like, do what makes you happy. And I was gone. I don't come from a place of scarcity. I honestly believe the money will come. And I say this to my girls. I use that phrase constantly, because I believe it's true. I have booked things where I didn't know where the money was going to come and it's turned up. I booked my first big modeling job when I had one mortgage payment left in my account. And I thought, where is that money going to come from? And then I was booked for the Specsavers advert. And whilst that wasn't a lot of money, it was enough until the next time. And gradually, I have worked to a point where my money script is not anxiety inducing, let's just put it that way, because I'm more likely to plan. My daughters and I have conversations about money a lot, and I want to be transparent about it, because in the past I haven't been, and I've been made to feel shamed for having a job that made more money than my partner, for example, or feeling that I wasn't worthy of spending money on, I don't know, a nice bag. Do you see what I mean? Whilst I don't buy stuff anymore, I'm very happy to drop a serious amount of money on having a very nice holiday. Thank you very much, because tomorrow isn't promised. I don't know whether that answers your question.
It does.
That's what you get.
Yeah, no, I love it. I love it. And I mean, honestly, Karen, I feel like I could talk to you all day. I say that with every single guest, but especially with you, because there's so much. And it's a shame that, you know, this is not video recording.
We're going to have to do a part two.
Yeah, we're going to have to do a part two. But I mean, in my final question, and I guess just riffing off one of the themes that you've touched on, which is about abundance, because you exude and radiate abundance in everything that you do. And anybody that follows you, I mean, I'm sure they will follow you after this episode, but you know, you're where you're happy. You know, we've talked through this episode, we've touched on the idea of the erasure of women as they get older. And I think I remember seeing you at a retreat in Jamaica shortly after COVID.
Oh my
gosh,
on the swing.
You were on a swing and you have on like bodies banging. You've got on like a string bikini, and I'm looking like, Dav, you need to get your life together, because no, look at Karen on the swing. There's no way you would be, if you were going on a swing in Jamaica, yeah, you might wear a bikini, but you'd be pulling and tugging it, because I've always had this kind of self-consciousness that, oh, people look at my boobs or whatever. Meanwhile, no one cares. Like no one's looking
care.
At you, Dav, right?
They're not looking at you.
And it's just an overhang from teenage years. But we've got all of these different quirks and insecurities. And I think one of my biggest blessings of island life, it's almost a blessing that I couldn't have predicted, but certainly one that I'm glad my daughters are able to absorb, is this freedom of body that I have here. I'm so liberated in my body here, because there are all types of different body shapes. All bodies are appreciated. And I go out and I'm super confident. I was always confident in the things that I wore, but I definitely wouldn't have been stripping off and putting on a bikini and just sitting and having lunch and having a rum punch in the bikini. But I remember watching you in that clip and being like, oh my God, that woman has found the solution. She has got the formula. And whatever it is, whatever the magic elixir is, she is the epitome of Rainmaker. And when I talk about, you know, the Rainmakers and the Rainmaker community, it's about women that are living life entirely on their own terms, unapologetically. And that is what you convey. And you convey the ups and the downs, but ultimately your ability to claim joy in as many moments as you possibly can, particularly as a Black woman, and particularly as a Black woman that is older. You know, you don't shy away from that reality. And for you, it's about, you know, expressing that in all of the different beautiful manifestations of what that looks and feels like, including being a grandmother, including being someone that has had all of these experiences that you can share with us so that we feel good about ourselves too. That kind of abundance, I think, speaks to a wealthy woman. But I don't want to put words in your mouth. What does being a wealthy woman mean to you? Because as I say, you know, this, you know, where you're happy, what does where you're happy mean? You know, your ability to step into silent Sundays. And I so admire you for that, because clearly I'm a chatterbox and I'm like, be silent for a whole day. Like, why would I willingly do that? I want to talk about what wealth means to you.
A wealth for me is health. Okay. I don't care how much money you've got in the bank, how many houses you've got, how many clothes you've got, how many friends you've got. If you are not physically healthy and mentally healthy, then it doesn't mean anything. And I learned that the hard way. You know, I the body keeps school, as the well-known book says, and years and decades of doing what I thought I should do rather than doing what filled my heart. And I understand why society has socialized us to value productivity over our own, you know, humanity, made me physically ill. And also mentally ill on two separate occasions. And so I have learned from that. And what I learned is that just slow down. Where you're happy is about making conscious clothing choices to lift your mood. I deliberately dress to make myself feel good. And where you're happy has a way of radiating out to other people. Random people smile at me, no matter what I'm wearing, whether I feel good, you know, what I wear, I feel confident in. I've always loved fashion, always been stylish, but loved the outside validation. The minute I left teaching, the minute I started to move through my depression and into better mental well-being was when I started to say, you know what? What will make me feel good? I'm going to wear that colour, or I'm going to wear that pair of earrings that my mum gave me and reminds me of her, or I'm going to put that head wrap on because it makes me feel like a queen, or I'm going to put this really sexy lingerie on, even though the only person who's going to see it is the mirror, you know? So I feel that when we start to choose ourselves, then it is so much easier to step out into the world, and it empowers other people to do the same. People ask me how I'm so confident. I've always been a loud person, but that loud person wasn't confident because I wasn't honest with myself or with anybody else. Now, what you see is what you get. So yes, my feed is joyful, but when I feel like, when I'm feeling shit, you'll also know about it. I don't shy away from saying, yesterday wasn't a great day, or I tried to wear my happy, but I still didn't feel great, so I went back to bed. And you know what? That's fine. The older we get, the older I get, let me talk about myself, not other people. I feel every day I'm grateful to draw breath. Every blinking day, I open my eyes. Today I had a little sob of gratitude. I'm lying in bed having a little, oh my God, everybody's being so nice about the book, you know. And then other times I wake up, I might not feel great because the world is, let's face it, it's a shit show. Mm. I forgot to ask if it was okay to swear on it. It's too late now, isn't it? You know, and other times I wake up and I feel rubbish, but I've still drawn breath and I still am so grateful to be able to look out my window and see the sea or put a kettle on or have hot and cold running water. Or, do you know what I mean? So how can I not be joyful? How can I not celebrate that? And when we celebrate, when we seek joy, it might be sunlight coming through a window. It might be a particularly delicious piece of cake. You know, it might be finding £5 in your back pocket when you're going through the pockets. When you put, whatever it is, if we intentionally seek joy every day, after a while, you don't have to look, it will find you.
Oh my God, Karen, what a mic drop moment for the end of this episode. Wow, it will find you.
It will.
I love that. Karen, thank you so, so much for being so generous with your insights and your time here today. Honestly, it felt like a major coup. You do not know the happy dance that I did when I randomly DM'd you on Instagram late at night thinking,
we're five hours
behind in the Caribbean. Like, she's not going to see this.
So I went to quick Google and I was like, you know what? Let me do this. Let's just do this.
I thought that. I was like, I mean, if she says no, Dav, no one's going to know. It's fine. And look, here we are.
Yeah.
I am truly grateful for you and for your insights today. Honestly, you've really, I live in sunshine, but you have totally been a sunbeam in today's episode.
Thank you.
Where can people, I mean, everybody, please go and follow the Karen Arthur.
Right. I've got a list. Yeah, guys, got a
tell
list.
Us.
So, first of all, Google Grandma's Locks, L-O-C-S, and pre-order that bugger, because the pre-orders are what gives the publisher, you know, it means that they know that they're going to have to print so many copies. You understand?
I'm going to order mine right after this episode.
So it's for anybody, any person from the African diaspora, but anybody who wants to champion inclusivity and allow themselves to stand tall in their hair journey. So that's that. Oh, I have a podcast, yeah. So podcast, Menopause Whilst Black, seasons 1 to 4 are on pod platforms, seasons 5 and 6 are on those and also on YouTube. And the last episode of season 6 drops on Friday, and that's me, which is a recap, which would actually be a good thing to listen to. So it'll probably come out after this drop. So that. I have a bi-weekly radio show on Gold Dust Radio. If you go to SoundCloud and put in Karen Arthur, all of the episodes will come up. And I just chat to Black folks every 2 weeks about what I feel like talking about, frankly. 9 of those episodes are talking to Black men about menopause, and the rest are talking to Black creatives. Basically, they allowed me to say what I like, so I say what I like. It's great. And I love it. I have a piece of art, textiles art, in Playing the Race Card exhibition. So if you're ever in Hastings in the UK at Hastings Museum and Art Gallery, you see, you asked me, so now I'm telling you.
Yes, go for it. You've got to go for it.
I have a piece there. It's worth seeing. That'll do. And I'm on Instagram. So I'm on Instagram as The Karen Arthur. I'm on Instagram as Menopause Whilst Black. And I'm on Instagram as Grandma's Locks. That'll do.
Oh, lovely. Lovely. All of that info will be in the show notes. Karen, thank you again for your time. Everybody, please go and pre-order Grandma's Locks. I'm
please.
Going to do it right now.
Yeah, I beg you.
Yes. Enjoy the rest of your day and looking forward to connecting with you again very soon. And meeting in real life.
Yay. Oh, yes. Thank you for having me, Davinia. It's been lovely.
Hi everyone, Davinia here. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode. If any of what you heard resonated and you'd like to find out more about how Raincheck is helping women all over the world build sustainable long-term wealth, then visit our website at raincheck.com and join the mailing list for more commentary, tips and opinion on how you can start taking steps to leveling up your financial well-being today. You can follow us on social media at Raincheck, and don't forget to share, like, rate, review and subscribe. See you next time.